when she wraps her legs around my waist, when I feel the heat of her against me, it undoes me, and I flip her onto her back on the bed and drop down over her. She draws circles on my chest, and then moves her hand lower, lower. I curse in Sariz and capture her wrist. "Me first," I say, tracing the indent of her stomach and, spurred on by her size, dropping my hand further, moving in time with her body until she arches her back, her arms trembling against my neck. As we both start to rid ourselves of clothes, our eyes meet. She smiles at me, a sweet smile, unsure and hopeful and bemused. I know that smile. I think about it all the time. But it is not a smile a dream could ever recreate. And this feeling within me, my desire, hers, they are also not emotions a dream could ever simulate. Could this be real? Could I have windwalked here somehow? Who bleeding cares? You're here now. But I hear something, whispers, the same whispers I heard when I was with the Bloodshrike, the djinn. A warning flares down my spine. This isn't a dream. Laia is here, in this inn. I am here. And if I'm here, then it's the djinn who have done it. How the bleeding hells did they move me? How did they know where Laia was? And why have they brought me here? I pull my hands away to sit up, and she growls in disappointment. You're right, I say. I am here. This is real, but it shouldn't be.
Elias, she laughs again. It has to be a dream, or we couldn't do this. But it is the best dream.
She reaches for me again, pulling me down.
You're exactly like you. Now, where were...
She pauses, and it's as if the world has frozen. Nothing moves, not even the shadows. A moment later, the world unfreezes, and Laia shudders, as if a chill has entered her very blood. Or her mind. For when she looks at me, she is no longer Laia. Her eyes are pure white, and I jump away from her as she shoves me, her strength unnatural. A ghost, my mind screams.
Skies, is she possessed?
Go back!
Her voice has completely changed, and I recognize it as the voice that spoke out of Shaver when I took my vow to become Soul Catcher. The voice that spoke to me in that strange in-between place when Shaver stole me away from the raid. Ma'atha's voice. Laia's whole body shifts, changing into shadow, her features faded, her body unfamiliar.
Where is she? I demand. What did you do with her? Go back. The djinn deceive you. They use your weakness against you. Go back.
Ma'atha, in Laia's shadow form, swings at me, as if trying to beat me toward the waiting place. I'm thrown backward by the blow.
Stop this!
I lift my hands.
Who brought me here? Was it you? Was it the djinn? The djinn, you fool,
says Ma'atha, for I won't allow myself to think of him as Laia, no matter what form he takes.
They siphon the power that you do not use. They strengthen themselves. They distract you with the lures of the human world. The more you feel, the more you fail. The more you fail, the stronger they become.
How are you talking to me? I say. Are you possessing her? Are you hurting her?
Her fate is not your concern.
Ma'atha shoves me, but I plant my feet.
Her life is not your concern.
If you've hurt her...
She will not remember this, any of this,
Ma'atha says.
Go back, surrender to me. Forget your past. Forget your humanity. You must. Do you see? Do you understand?
I cannot, I say. It's part of me, but I need the magic.
The magic will allow you to pass the ghosts through with nary a thought. It will allow you to quell the djinn. But you must leave your old self behind. You are Elias Vittorius no more. You are the soul catcher. You are mine. I know what your heart desires. It can never be.
I tried desperately to push those wishes away. So stupid, so small. A house and a bed and a garden and laughter and a future.
Forget your dreams.
Martha's anger mounts.
Forget your heart. There is only your vow to serve me. Love cannot live here. Seek out the djinn. Find their secrets. Then you will understand.
I'll never understand, I say. I'll never let go of what I fought so hard to keep.
You must, Elias. Otherwise, all is lost.
Martha spins out of Lyre, a teeming cyclone of cindered shadows, and she collapses in a heap. I take one step toward her before Martha yanks me into darkness. Seconds or minutes or hours later, I slam into the singed earth outside Shaver's cabin. Warm summer rain falls in sheets, drenching me within seconds. Bleeding, burning hells, it was real. I was with Lyre in Marin, and she won't even remember it. I was with the Bloodshrike in Navium. Did she survive her wound? I should have helped her, gotten her to the barracks. Just thinking of them ignites Martha's wrath. I double over, hissing at the fire that tears through me.
Seek out the djinn. Find their secrets.
Martha's order rings through my head. But I sought the djinn's help once before. They used it to bedevil me so the spirits could escape. The commandant's words float through my mind. There is success, and there is failure. The land in between is for those too weak to live. I need to get to the magic. And to do that, Martha, at least, thinks I need the djinn. But this time, I won't go to those creatures as Elias Vittorius. I won't even go to them as the Soul Catcher. I'll go to them as Mask Vittorius, Dread Marshal, Soldier of the Empire. I'll go to them as the estranged, murderous son of the Bitch of Blackcliff, as the monster who killed his friends and assassinated the Empire's enemies as a child, and who watched stonily as yearlings were whipped to death before his eyes. This time, I will not ask the djinn for help. I will take it.
Chapter 25. The Bloodshrike. You are Bloodshrike of the Empire, and you are meant to survive. Who spoke the words? I try to grasp at the memory. Someone was here, on this dark street with me. A friend. But when I open my eyes and pull myself to my knees, I am alone, left with nothing but the echo of those words. My knees shake as I try to pull myself to my feet. But no matter how deeply I breathe, I can't get any bleeding air. Because you're losing all your blood, Shrike. I rip off my cloak and tie it around my stomach, groaning at the pain of it. Now is when I need a damned patrol to pass. But of course the Commandant, who no doubt planned this, would make sure there was none. But there might be more assassins. I have to get up, get to the Blackguard barracks. Why? A voice whispers. The darkness waits with open arms. Your family waits. Mother, father, I need to remember something about them. I fist my hands and feel something cold, round. I look down. A ring. A bird in flight. You are all that holds back the darkness. Someone said those words to me. But no, those words do not matter. Not against the pain that slams through me. Waves and waves of it. You are all that holds back the darkness. The memory burns in my mind. I put a hand to my eyes, and my mask ripples. The cool metal lends me strength, as nothing else can, snapping me out of my torpor. My father spoke those words to me. Livia, the baby, the regency, my family lives, the empire lives, and I must protect both. I crawl forward, teeth gritted, enraged at the tears streaming unchecked down my face at the astounding pain of my wound. Break it down. How many steps to the barracks? It's a quarter mile from here at least. 500 strides at most. 500 strides is nothing. What about when you get there? What if someone sees you? Will you let your men see you weak? What if someone spots you on the way? The assassin can't possibly be alone. Then I will fight his accomplices too, and I will live, because if I do not, all is lost. I look down at my father's ring and force myself forward, taking strength from it. I am a mask. I am an Aquila. I am the Bloodshrike. Pain is nothing. I reach the wall of a nearby house and drag myself to my feet. The houses are darkened at this time of night, and though I might find aid at one of them, I might also find enemies. The commandant is nothing if not thorough. If she sent an assassin, then she'd pay off the street where he was meant to kill me, to make sure no one helped. Move, Shrike. I make it down the street before my legs begin feeling strange. Cold. I slow down, hoping to catch my breath. And then suddenly, I'm not moving anymore. I'm on my knees. Bleeding hells. I know this feeling. Weakness. Uselessness. Helplessness. I felt it before, after Marcus stabbed me during the first trial. Elias saved me then, because he is my friend. How could I ever see him as anything else after what we have been through? If I am sorry for anything now, before the end, it is that I hunted him, that I hurt his family, that I hurt him. Will I see him now, in the waiting place? Will he welcome me? What folly that he is chained to that place. What folly when this world needs his light. You deserved better, I whisper. Shrike! The scrape of boots has me baring my teeth and brandishing my dagger. But I recognize the black hair and gold skin, and though I'm confused, I'm not really surprised, because he is my best friend after all, and he'd never let me just die. You came. Shrike, listen to me. Stay awake. Stay with me. But no, it's not Elias. The voice doesn't offer the slow, deep warmth of summer. It's cool and harsh, all wrong. It's winter, like me. Then there's another voice, also familiar. Dex. There's a physician in the Aquila house. Get him, the cool voice says. Help me with her armor first. She'll be easier to carry. Careful with her stomach. I know the first voice now. Avitas Harper. Strange, quiet Harper. Thoughtful and watching and filled with an emptiness that calls to me. He works quickly to unbuckle my armor, and I stifle a moan when it comes off. Dex's handsome, dark face, strained in the half-light, clarifies. A good soldier. A true friend. But he's always in pain. Always alone. Hiding. It's not fair. I whisper to him. You should love whom you wish. How the Empire would treat you if they knew. It's not... Dex's face pales, and he glances quickly at Avitas.
Save your strength, Shrike, he says.
Then he's gone, and a muscled arm comes around my waist. Harper pulls my hand across his shoulders, and we take a step, another, but I'm staggering. I've lost too much blood. Pick me up, you idiot, I gasp. A moment later, I am weightless, and I sigh.
You're going to be fine, Hell, Shrike,
a crack in Harper's voice. Emotion? Fear? Don't let anyone see me, I whisper. This is undignified. A bark of laughter.
Only you would think that while your guts are leaking out onto the damned pavement. Hold on, Bloodshrike. The barracks aren't far.
He makes for the front entrance, and I shake my head emphatically. Take me through the back. The plebeians we're sheltering can't see me like this.
We don't have a choice. The fastest way to the infirmary is through the front door.
No! I thrash and shove Harper's chest. He doesn't so much as twitch. They cannot see me like this. You know what she'll do. She'll use it against me. The paters already think I'm weak.
Captain Avitas Harper.
Harper freezes at the voice, deep and ancient and brooking no argument.
Bring her this way.
You get the bleeding hells away from us.
Harper backs away two steps, but the Nightbringer holds out his hands.
I could kill you both with a thought, child, he says softly. If you wish for her to live, bring her.
Harper hesitates for a moment, and then follows. I want to protest, but my mouth is unable to form words. His body is taut as a wire pulled tight, heart thudding swift like a river current. But his masked face is serene. Some part of me relaxes. My sight darkens. Ah, sleep.
Stay with me, Shrike.
Harper speaks sharply, and I groan in protest.
Keep your eyes open. You don't have to speak. All you have to do is stay awake.
I force myself to focus on the swirling robes of the Nightbringer. He whispers, but I cannot make out the words. A brick wall that rose before us disappears. Magic. Moments later, the barracks come into view. The guards stationed outside look up, hands on their sims. But the Nightbringer speaks again, and they turn away as if they haven't seen us.
Set her down, Captain.
We enter my quarters, and the Nightbringer gestures to my bed.
And then, leave.
Harper settles me onto the bed slowly. Still I grimace, another wave of pain washing over me at the strain on my wound. When he backs away, I feel cold.
I will not leave her.
He straightens and looks the Nightbringer in the face without flinching. The Nightbringer considers.
Very well. Get out of the way.
The djinn sits beside me on the bed. He throws back my shirt and I catch a glimpse of his hand beneath the sleeve of his robe. It is shadowy and twisted, with an eerie glow beneath the darkness that makes me think of banked embers. I think of a day long ago in Sarah, the first time I met him. I remember how he sang, just one note, and the bruises on my face healed.
Why are you helping me?
I cannot help you, the Nightbringer says. You can, however, help yourself.
Can't heal myself.
Your healing power allows you to recover more quickly than a normal human,
he says. Distantly, I realize that Avitas is hearing all of this, that maybe I should have had him leave the room, but I am too weak to care.
How else could you still live, child, after losing so much blood? Consider the wound. and then find your song. Do it. Now.
The words are not a request, but an order. I hum tunelessly, fighting the pain, searching for my song. I close my eyes and I am a girl again, comforting Hannah when she came into my bed at night, terrified of monsters. Mother would find us huddling together and sing us to sleep. Sometimes in the deep night at Blackcliff, thinking of her song brought me peace. But when I sing now, nothing happens. Why would it? My song is not one of peace. It is one of failure and pain. My song is one of battle and blood, death and power. It is not the song of Helene Aquila. It is the song of the Bloodshrike. And I cannot find it. I cannot wrap my mind around it. This is it, then. Cut down on the street like a drunk civvy who couldn't tell a blade from a bottle. The Nightbringer sings two notes. Rage, I think. Love. A raw, cold world lives in that short song. My world. Me. I sing the two notes back to him. Two notes become four. Four become 14. Rage for my enemies, I think. Love for my people. This is my song. But it hurts. Bleeding hells, it hurts. The Nightbringer takes my hand.
Pour the pain into me, child, he says. Turn it away from yourself.
His words unleash a flood. Even as the burden of my wound transfers to him, he does not flinch. He does not move at all, his cloaked form a statue as he accepts it. My skin stitches itself back together, burning with an ache that makes me cry out. A blade hisses as it leaves its sheath.
What the bleeding hells did you do to her?
The Nightbringer turns to Avatas and gestures. Immediately, Harper drops the sim as if burned.
Look.
The djinn moves, nodding down to my wound, which is now nothing but a star-shaped scar. It weeps blood, but it will not kill me. Harper's low oath tells me that I will soon have a great deal of explaining to do, but I can worry about that later. My body is exhausted, but when the Nightbringer releases me, I make myself sit up.
Wait, I whisper. Will you tell her of this?
He knows of whom I speak.
Why would I tell her? So that she can attempt to kill you again? I am not her servant, Bloodshrike. She is mine. She attacked you against my orders. I have no patience for defiance. Thus, I have thwarted her.
I don't understand. Why would you help me? What do you want from me?
I am not helping you, Bloodshrike.
He stands and gathers his robes.
I am helping myself.
When I wake, night has fallen, and the rafters shudder with reverberations of catapult projectiles. The barbarians must have recommenced their bombardment of Navium. I am alone in my room, but my armor is hung neatly from the wall. A curse slips through my lips as I rise. My wound has gone from deadly to irritatingly painful. Stop whinging. Get your armor on. I limp to the wall, every joint as stiff as an old woman's in deep winter. I hope a few minutes on my feet will warm up my body enough that I can at least ride.
Off to get yourself killed again so soon.
The familiar rasp is so unexpected that I don't believe I'm hearing it at first.
Your mother would be appalled.
Cook perches in the window as usual.
And even with the hood, even though I've seen her scars before, the violence of her mangled face is jarring enough that I look away. Her cloak is ripped, her shock of white hair a bird's nest. The yellow stains on her fingers tell me immediately who has been leaving clay statues in the Commandant's quarters.
I heard you got stabbed.
The cook drops into the room.
Thought I'd come yell at you for allowing it to happen.
She shakes her head.
You're a fool. You should know better than to walk alone at night within 100 miles of the bitch of Blackcliff.
And leave you to kill her, I snort. Hasn't worked out well for you, has it? All you've done is left a few disturbing statues in her quarters. Cook grins, an eerie thing.
I'm not trying to kill her.
She does not elaborate. Her gaze drops to my stomach.
You haven't thanked me for murdering the other assassins who were coming for you. All for telling Harper to stop squinting at reports so we could drag your carcass to safety.
Thank you, I say.
I trust you know that sun-eyed bastard wants something from you.
I don't waste time asking how she knows the Nightbringer healed me. I don't trust him, I tell her. I'm not a fool.
Then why did you let him help you? He's planning a war, did you know? And he's likely got a part in it for you. You just don't know what it is yet.
A war? I sit up. The war with the Karkans? Cook hisses, snatches a candle off a table near the door, and throws it at my head.
Not that war, stupid. The war. The one that's been brewing since the day my idiot people decided it would be wise to attack and destroy the djinn. That's what this is all about, girl. That's what the Commandant is up to. It's not just the Karkans she wants to defeat.
Explain yourself, I say. What are you...
Get out of here,
she says.
Get far away from the Commandant. She's set on taking you down, and she'll have her way. Go to your sister. Keep her safe. Keep that emperor of yours in check. And when the war does come, be ready for it.
I must take down the Commandant first, I say. This war you speak of. A step sounds in the hallway beyond the door. Cook leaps into the window, one hand coiled around the frame. I notice something strange about that hand. The skin is smooth, not young like mine, but not the skin of a white-haired granny either. Those dark blue eyes pin me.
You want to take down the bitch of Blackcliff? You want to destroy her? You have to become her first. And you don't have it in you, girl.
Chapter 26. Liar. I am fuzzy-headed and confused when I pull on my boots. I've slept all day. Such strange dreams I had. Wonderful, and yet...
Liar! Moose's voice is a low hiss at the door. Bleeding hells, are you all right? Liar!
The door bursts open before I can get a word out, and Moose takes 2 steps in and grabs my shoulders as if to make sure I am real.
Get your things.
He scans the windows and beneath the bed.
We need to get the hells out of here.
What's happened? I say. My thoughts immediately go to the Nightbringer, to his minions. Is he?
Wraiths.
Moose's face is pale to the color of an unpolished sim.
They attacked Tribe Salud, and they might be coming for us.
Oh no, no. The Kehani!
I don't know if she's alive, he says, and we can't risk finding out. Come on.
We race down the back stairs of the inn and out to the stables as silently as possible. It is late enough that most of the village is in bed, and waking anyone would only bring about questions, and a delay.
The Wraiths killed everyone silently, Moose says. I wouldn't have known anything was wrong if the Whites hadn't woken me up.
I pause as I throw a saddle onto my horse. We should make sure there are no survivors. Moose swings up onto his mount.
If we go into that camp, skies know what we'll find.
I faced a wraith before. I finish with my horse. There were nearly 50 tribes people in that camp, Musa. If even one of them is alive, Musa shakes his head.
Most of them left early. Only a few wagons stayed with the Kehani to keep watch over her until she was ready to leave. And she stayed because of us, I say.
Which is why we owe it to her to make sure neither she nor any of her kinsmen needs help. He groans in protest, but follows me as I leave the stables and head for the camp. I expect it to be silent, but the steady drizzle of rain pings off the wagon roofs, making it difficult for us to hear our own footsteps. The first body is sprawled at the entrance to the encampment. It is wrong, broken in a dozen different ways. A lump rises in my throat. I recognize the man, one of the tribesmen who welcomed us. Three more of his family members lie a few yards from him. I know instantly that they too are dead. But we do not see the Kehani. A quiet chitter near Musa's ear tells me that the whites have noticed her absence too. Musa nods to the Kehani's wagon. When I make for it, Musa puts an arm in front of me.
Happen.
The strain on his face matches the foreboding in my heart.
Maybe I should go first.
In case... I saw the inside of Koff Prison, Musa. I slip past him. It can't be any worse. The back door opens silently, and I find the Kehani, crumpled against the far wall. She looks so much smaller than she did just hours ago. An old woman whose last story was stolen from her. The wraiths did not cut her. In fact, I do not see a single open wound. But the odd angles of her limbs tell me exactly how she died. I clap my hand against my mouth to hold back my sick. Skies, she must have been in so much pain. A moan comes from her, and both Musa and I jump. Oh, bleeding hells! I am by her side in two steps. Musa, go to the horses. Look in the right saddlebag. No. The Kehani's sunken eyes gleam with faint, failing light. Listen. Musa and I both fall silent. We can barely hear her over the rain. Seek out the Augur's words, she whispers. Prophecy. The great library. Augur's, I don't understand. What do the Augurs have to do with the Nightbringer? Are they allies? Of a kind, the Kehani whispers. Of a kind. Her eyelids droop. She is gone. From the wagon door, a loud, panicked chitter sounds.
Let's go, Musa hisses. The wraiths are circling back. They know we're here.
With the panic of the whites spurring us, we race through the rain at a pace that drives the horses into a frothing sweat. I'm sorry, I think the words over and over, but I don't know to whom I speak. My horse for making it suffer, the Kehani for asking her a question that killed her, the tribesman who died trying to protect her.
The Augur's prophecies, Musa says when we finally slow our horses for a rest. The only place we'll find them is the great library. She was trying to tell us, but it's impossible to get in.
Nothing is impossible. Elias's words come back to me. We'll get in. We must. But first, we have to make it back. Again, we push through the night, but this time, Musa needs no urging. I spend half the ride looking over my shoulder, and the other half plotting ways to get into the great library. The sky is clear, but the roads are still treacherous with mud. The whites remain near us, their wings occasionally flashing in the dark, their presence offering a strange comfort. When the walls of Edessa come into view in the deepest hour of the night, I want to sob in relief until the hazy glow of flame materializes.
The refugee camp, Musa urges his horse on. They're burning the tents.
What the hell's happened? But Musa has no answer. The camp is in such chaos when we reach it that the mariners, frantically evacuating the scholars, do not notice two more faces amid the hundreds running through the narrow, ash-filled lanes. Musa disappears to speak to one of the mariners before finding me again.
I don't think the mariners did this, Musa shouts over the roar of the flames. Otherwise, why would they be helping? And how could the fire have spread so quickly? One of the soldiers I spoke with said they caught wind of it only an hour ago.
We plunge into the smoke-choked streets, tearing open tents, pulling out those who are sleeping, who remained unaware, shooing children to the outskirts of the camp. We do whatever we can, however we can, with the frantic anguish of those who know that nothing will be enough. Screams rise around us from those who are trapped, from those who cannot find their family members, from those who have found their family members injured or dead. Always us. My eyes burn from smoke, my face is wet. Always my people. Musa and I go back again and again, carrying out those who cannot walk themselves, pulling to safety as many scholars as we can. A mariner soldier hands us water to drink, to give to the survivors. I freeze when she looks up. It is Captain Aliba, her eyes red-rimmed, hands trembling. She meets my gaze, but only shakes her head and turns back to her own tasks. You'll be all right. All is well. You'll be fine. I speak nonsense to those who are burned, who cough blood from all the smoke. Of course we'll find your mother, your daughter, your grandson, your sister. Lies, so many lies. I hate myself for telling them, but the truth is crueler. Hundreds are still trapped in the camp when I notice something strange through the smoke and haze. A red glow rises from the city of Adisa. My throat is parched, burned from inhaling so much smoke, but suddenly, it goes even more dry. Has the fire from the camp spread? But no, it couldn't have. Not over the massive city wall. I back away from the refugee camp, hoping I can see better from outside it. Dread spreads slowly through my body, the same feeling I've had when something terrible has happened, and I wake up having forgotten. And then, I remember. Cries rise up all around me, like ill spirits let loose. I am not the only one who has noticed the glow from Adisa. Musa, the scholar man lurches back toward the camp, desperate to save even one more person.
Look.
I pull him around to face the city. A warm wind off the ocean parts the fog of smoke over the camp for a moment. That's when we see it. To call the fire enormous would be like calling the commandant unkind. It is immense, an inferno that transforms the sky into a lurid nightmare. The thick cloud of smoke is illuminated by the flames, impossibly high, as if shooting from the depths of the earth to the very heavens.
Liar, Musa's voice is weak. It's...
But he doesn't have to say it. I knew as soon as I saw the height of the flames. No other building in Adisa is so tall. The Great Library. The Great Library is on fire.
Chapter 27. Elias. For 2 weeks, I plot how I'll seize the truth from the djinn. The mercantile in a nearby village provides most of what I need. The rest depends on the weather, which finally cooperates when an early summer storm sweeps in from the east, drenching the entirety of the waiting place. I don't mind the rain. I catch a dozen buckets worth of it. By the time I transport them to the djinn grove, the deluge has dulled the unholy glow of the trees to an ochreous red. Once in the grove, I smile, waiting for the djinn to begin tormenting me. Come on, you devils. Watch me, listen to my thoughts, squirm over what's coming. When I am past the first row of trees, the canopy grows tangled. All is silent, but the air thickens, weighing me down, as if I'm walking through water in full martial armor. It is an effort to remove the bag of salt I have stowed away. But as I make rings of salt around the trees, the djinn stir, snarling softly from within their prisons. I take out an axe, its steel edge freshly sharpened, and give it a few test swings. Then I dip it in the bucket of rainwater and sink it 6 inches into the closest gin tree. The shriek that arises from the grove is both hair-raising and horribly satisfying.
You're keeping secrets, I say. I want to know them. Tell me, and I'll stop.
You fool! Cut open the trees, and we will simply burst forth.
Lies!
I slip into the voice of a mask, as if I were interrogating a prisoner.
If your freedom was that simple, you'd have gotten your Ifrit friends to break you out long ago.
I dip the axe in the rainwater again, and, on inspiration, scoop up some of the salt to rub on it. At my second strike, the djinn screams so loudly that the ghosts clustered nearby streak away. When I lift the axe for a third time, the djinn speak.
Stop! Please! Come closer.
If you're tricking me...
If you want our secrets, you must take them. Come closer.
I move deeper into the grove, the axe clutched tightly. Mud slimes my boots.
Closer.
Every step grows more difficult, but I drag myself forward until I can't move at all.
How does it feel to be trapped, soul catcher?
Quite suddenly, I cannot speak or see or feel anything beyond the steady thud of my heart. I fight against the darkness, the silence. I cast myself against the walls of this prison like a moth caught in a jar. In my panic, I reach for my Arthur, but the magic doesn't respond.
How does it feel to be chained?
What the hell's, I rasp, are you doing to me?
Look, Elias Veturius, you wanted our secrets. They are before you.
Suddenly, I am free of their grasp. The trees ahead thin out as the land curves to arise. I stagger toward it and find myself looking down a slope at a shallow valley, nestled in a bend of the fast-rushing river Dusk. And in that valley are dozens, no, hundreds of stone structures. It's a city I've never seen, a city Shaver never mentioned, a city that has never made itself known to me on the strange internal map I have of the waiting place. It looks and feels in my mind like empty space.
What is this place?
I ask. A bird sails down into the valley through the thick sheets of rain, some small, squirming creature caught in its claws. The treetops sway in the wind, heaving like a restless sea.
Home.
The djinn speak without rancor for once.
This is home.
My Arthur nudges me forward, and I make my way through tall, soaked summer grasses down into the city, dagger at the ready. It is unlike any city I've ever seen. The streets curved in concentric half-circles around a building on the banks of the river Dusk. The streets, the buildings, everything is made of the same strange black stone. The color is so pure that I reach out more than once to touch it, awestruck by its depth. I soon sheath my dagger. I've been in enough graveyards to know what they feel like. There isn't a soul in the place. There aren't even ghosts. Though I want to explore every single street, I'm drawn to the large building on the riverbank. It's bigger than the Emperor's Palace at Antium, and 100 times more beautiful. Stone blocks sit upon one another with such perfect symmetry that I know no human cut them. I see no columns or domes or innate patterns. The structures in the Empire or Marin or the tribal deserts reflect their people. Those cities laugh and cry and shout and snarl. This city is one note, the purest note ever sung, held until my heart wants to break at the sound. A low set of stairs leads to the main building. At my touch, the two massive doors at the top of the stairs open as easily, as if their hinges were oiled this morning. Within, 3 dozen blue fire torches sputter to life. Which is when I realized that the walls, which appeared to be a deep black stone, are something else entirely. They reflect the flame, like water reflects sunlight, transforming the entire room to a gentle sapphire blue. Though the massive windows are open to the elements, the thunder of the storm outside is muted to a murmur. I cannot make heads or tails of what this place is. Its size makes me think it was used for gatherings, yet there is only one low bench in the center of the room. Martha tugs me up a staircase, through a series of antechambers, and into another room with a huge window. It is filled with the scents of the river and the rain. Torches paint the room white. I lift my hand to touch the wall. When I do, it comes alive, filled with misty images. I yank my hand back and the images fade. Gingerly, I touch it again. At first, I cannot understand the pictures. Animals play, leaves dance on the wind, tree hollows transform into kindly faces. The images remind me of Mamie Reeler, of what her voice is like when she sings a tale. Which is when I understand. These are children's stories. Children lived here, but not human children. Home, the djinn said. Djinn children. I make my way, room by room, to the top of the building, stopping in a high rotunda that overlooks the city and the river. When I touch the walls, images appear again. This time, though, they are of the city itself. Strips of orange and yellow and green silk flutter in the windows. Jewel-like flowers grow in overflowing boxes. The trill and hum of voices tell of a happier time. People clad in smoky black robes walk the city. One woman has dark skin and tight curls, like Dex's. Another has pale skin and fine hair, like the Bloodshrikes. Some are sim-thin, and others are heavier, like Mamie was before the Empire got its hands on her. Each, in their own way, walks with a grace that I only ever saw in Shaver. But they do not walk alone. All are surrounded by ghosts. I spot a man with auburn hair and a face so beautiful I can't even be irritated by it. He is surrounded by ghost children, love suffusing every bit of him as he speaks with them. I can't hear what he says, but I can understand his intent. He offers the ghosts love, not judgment or anger or questions. One by one, the spirits drift into the river at ease, at peace. Is this, then, the secret of what Shaver did? I've only to offer the spirits love and they'll move on. It can't be. It's antithetical to everything she said about quelling my emotions. The ghosts here are calm, far more serene than they were when Shaver lived. I do not sense the frantic pain that suffuses the waiting place as I know it. There are also far fewer of them. Little groups of them follow the black-robed figures obediently. Instead of a lone soul-catcher, there are dozens, no, hundreds. Other figures drift from the buildings, human in form, but made of deep black and red flame, glorious and free. Here and there I spot children switching from human to flame and back with the rapidity of a hummingbird's wings. When the soul catchers and their ghosts pass, the djinn move aside, inclining their heads. The children watch from afar, mouths agog. They whisper, and their body language reminds me of how martial children act when a mask passes by. Fear, awe, envy. And yet the soul catchers are not isolated. They speak to each other. One woman smiles when a flame child comes running toward her, transforming into a human just before the djinn scoops him up. They have family, partners, children. An image of Lyra and me in a house, making a life together, flashes through my mind. Could it be possible? The city ripples, a frisson of sorts, a portent made manifest in the shiver in the air. The djinn turn to the rim of their valley, where a row of flags fly, green with a purple quill and an open book, the sigil of the Scholar Empire before it fell. The images come swiftly. A young human king arrives with his retinue. The auburn-haired djinn welcomes him, a brown-skinned djinn woman at his side, and two flame children fidgeting behind them. The djinn wears a crown with discomfort, as if he's not used to it. I finally recognize him. The hair is different, as is the build, but something about his manner is familiar. This is the king of no name, the Nightbringer. Flanking the king and his queen are two flame-formed djinn bodyguards, armed with black diamond sickles. Despite their non-human physiques, I recognize the one who stands by the children. Shaver. She watches the visiting scholar king with fascination. He notices. The images speed up. The scholar king wheedles, then cajoles, then demands the secrets of the djinn. The Nightbringer rejects him, but the scholar king refuses to give up. Shaver meets the scholar in his guest quarters. Over weeks, he befriends her, laughs with her, listens to her, scheming even as she falls desperately in love with him. A sense of foreboding grows, thick as mud. The Nightbringer haunts the streets of his own city when everyone's sleeping, sensing a threat. When his wife speaks to him, he smiles. When his children play with him, he laughs. Their fears are quelled. His only grow. Shaver finds the Scholar King in a clearing beyond the city. His manner reminds me of someone, but the knowledge wavers at the edges of my mind before slipping away. Shaver and the scholar argue. He calms her anger, makes promises. Even at the distance of 1,000 years, I know he'll break those promises. 3 moons rise and set. Then the scholars attack, tearing into the forest of dusk with steel and fire. The djinn cast them back easily, but with bewilderment. They do not understand this. They know the humans want their power. But why, when we keep the balance? Why, when we take the spirits of your dead and move them on so that you are not haunted by them? Ghosts fill the city, but the djinn must fight, so there are not enough soul catchers to move the spirits on. Forced to wait and suffer, the spirits cry out, their wails an eerily prescient dirge. The djinn king meets with the Ifrit lords as the scholars press the attack. His flame children are sent far away with hundreds of others, howling tearful goodbyes to their parents. The images follow the children into the forest. Oh no, no! I want to pull my hand from the wall to stop the images. Danger closes in on the little ones. The crack of a twig, a shadow flitting among the trees. And all the while, these waist-high flame children scurry through the forest. They are unknowing, illuminating the trunks and leaves and grasses with brilliance, some deep fey magic that lends beauty to all that they touch. Their whispers sound like bells, and they move like cheery, brave little campfires on a freezing night. A sudden silence descends.
You're walking into an ambush! Protect them, you fools!
I want to scream at the guards. Humans pour from the trees, armed with swords gleaming with summer rain. The flame children cluster together, terrified. As they join, their fire burns brighter. And then their flames go out. I don't want to see any more. I know the tale. Shaver gave the Scholar King the star. He and his coven of magic users locked away the djinn.
Do you see now, Elias Vittorius?
The djinn ask. We destroyed you, I say.
You destroyed yourselves. For 1,000 years, you've had only one soul catcher. Shaver, at least, was djinn. Her magic was innate. Still, the ghosts built up. You saw her struggle. But you have no magic. How can a talentless mortal do that which a djinn could not? The ghosts press against the borders, like rainwater presses against a dam. And you will never move the ghosts swiftly enough to stop the dam from bursting. You will fail.
For once, the djinn play no tricks. They do not need to. The truth in their words is terrifying enough.
Chapter 28. The Bloodshrike. Night is thick on Navium when I jerk out of sleep. The beach. I don't realize I've spoken the words aloud until I hear the creak of armor. Avitas, keeping watch in a chair near my door, shudders awake, sim in hand.
Some guard you make, I snort. You were fast asleep. My apologies, Shrike, he says stiffly. I have no excuse.
I roll my eyes. That was a joke. I swing my legs out of the bed and search around for my breeches. Avitas reddens and faces the wall, drumming his fingers on his dagger's hilt.
Don't tell me you've not seen a naked soldier before, Captain.
A long pause, then a chuckle, low and husky. It makes me feel strange, like he's about to tell me a secret, like I would lean in closer to hear it.
Not one like you, Bloodshrike.
Now my skin feels hot, and I open my mouth, trying to think of a retort. Nothing. Skies, I'm relieved he can't see me over here, red as a tomato and gaping like a fish. Don't act the fool, Shrike. I lace my pants, throw on a tunic and grab my armor, pushing away my embarrassment. At Blackcliff, I saw Dex, Farris, Elias, all of my friends, stripped down to absolutely nothing, and I didn't bat an eyelid. I'm not about to humiliate myself with blushes over this. I have to get to the beach. I yank on my braces, wincing at the twinge in my stomach. I have to see if... I don't want to say it, or even think it, in case I'm utterly deluded.
Would you care to explain that first?
Harper nods to my stomach. Right. He saw me heal myself. He heard what the Nightbringer said.
I would not. Sylvius, the physician, came to check on you at Dex's request. I didn't let him in. Told him Dex exaggerated the seriousness of your wound. And he mentioned that a group of children in the Aquila Infirmary saw miraculous improvement in a very short span of time.
Harper pauses. And when I say nothing, he sighs in exasperation.
I'm your second, Shrike, but I don't know your secrets, and so I cannot protect you when others try to ferret them out.
I don't need protection.
You are second in command of the Empire, he says. If you didn't need protection, it would be because no one saw you as a threat. Needing protection is not a weakness. Refusing to trust your allies is.
Harper's voice rarely rises above the familiar monotone of a mask. Now it cracks like a whip, and I gaze at him in surprise.
Shut it and get out. I don't have time for this.
I only just stop myself from saying it, because he's not wrong.
You'll want to sit down for this, I say.
When I finish telling him of the magic, the Ifrit, healing Elias and then Lyra, and all that came after, he looks thoughtful. I expect him to ask questions, to delve deeper, to push for more.
No one will know of it, he says, until you're ready. Now, you mentioned the beach.
I am surprised that he moved on so quickly, but I am thankful too. I heard a story when I was young, I say,
about the Nightbringer, a djinn whose people were imprisoned by the scholars, who has lived for 1,000 years fueled by the desire to wreak vengeance on them.
And this is relevant because...
What if there is a war coming? Not the war with the Corkans, but a bigger war. I can't explain the feeling I got when Cook spoke of it, a shiver on my skin. Her words had the weight of truth to them. I think back to what Quinn said of the Nightbringer. What does he want? Will she get it for him? What could she be doing for the Paters that they would agree to let that swine Grimmar wreak havoc in the poor parts of the city? You heard the Nightbringer. The Commandant isn't an ally or a compatriot. She's his servant. If he wants a war with the scholars, then she's the one who will help him carry it out. She's destroyed the scholars within the Empire. Now she looks to those who have escaped.
To Marin. Harper shakes his head. She'd need a fleet to take on the Mariners. Their navy is unparalleled.
Exactly. I curse in pain as I pull on my armor, and Arvitas is at my side in a second, buckling it with careful fingers. Though I wonder, Karis wouldn't help the Nightbringer out of loyalty. You heard Quinn. She's loyal only to herself. So what's he offering her in return?
The Empire, Harper says. The throne. Though if that were the case, why did he save your life?
I shake my head. I do not know. I need to get to the beach, I say. I'll explain later. Get me those reports on the Paters and their holdings. Tell the plebeians about the infirmaries and the shelters. Open more. Seek the help of our allies. Requisition houses if you must. Make sure the flag of the Shrike and the flag of the Emperor fly wherever the plebeians are offered shelter. If I'm right, we're going to need plebeian support soon. I find a dark cloak, tuck my hair under a scarf and slip out the door, every sense heightened. I feel the pull of the plebeians who lie injured in the courtyard of the Blackguard barracks, but I force myself to ignore them. Tonight, I must work a different sort of magic. Though I take the tunnels into the city, eventually I ascend into Narvium's streets. The Commandant has patrols out everywhere, watching for Corkans attempting to penetrate the city. Though the beach is only 2 miles from the Blackguard barracks, it takes me nearly 3 hours to get there, and even then, I double back twice to make sure I wasn't followed. When I close in on the beach, I spy the guards immediately. Most lurk along the low, rugged cliffs that run down to the wide swath of sand, but many patrol the beach itself. Ostensibly, the soldiers are here to ensure that Grimmar doesn't land his men on the beaches without anyone knowing. But if that were the only reason, there wouldn't be so many of them. No, there's another reason they're here. The Commandant is taking no chances. She must know that I recovered. I slip from the shadow of a bungalow and scurry toward a shed barely taller than I am. Once ensconced, I check my kerchief, slather my mask with mud from a tin I've brought with me, and bolt for the corner of a tackle shop that lies even closer to the beach. I edge nearer until finally I am close enough to realize that there is no way to get down to that beach without someone noticing. Not without backup, anyway. Bleeding, burning skies. I wish suddenly for Elias. Impossible jobs with low likelihood of success are Elias's forte. Somehow he always pulled them off, no matter the cost, and usually with a cheeky comment. It was both inspiring and irritating. But Elias isn't here, and I can't risk getting caught. Frustrated, I back away, which is when a shadow appears beside me. My sim is half-drawn when a hand clumps over my mouth. I bite it and elbow my attacker, who hisses in pain, but, like me, remains silent, lest the Commandant's men hear. Cedar. Cinnamon.
Harper? I hiss. Bleeding Elshrike, he gasps. You've sharp elbows.
You idiot! Skies, I wish I didn't have to whisper. I wish I could turn the full force of my rage against him. What the hells are you doing here? I gave you orders.
I passed Dex your orders.
Harper at least looks somewhat apologetic, but that does little to soften my anger.
This is a two-mask job, Shrike. Shall we get to it before we're discovered?
Curse him, he is aggravating. More so because he's right, again. I elbow him a second time, knowing it's childish but delighting in his pained oof.
Go distract those fools. I nod to the nearest cluster of guards and make it good. If you're here, you might as well not muck it up.
He disappears, and not an hour later, I am flitting away from the beach, having seen what I needed to see. Harper meets me at our prearranged spot, only slightly worse for wear after tricking the soldiers into thinking that a Corkan raiding party had turned up nearby.
Well?
He asks. I shake my head. I don't know whether to be thrilled or horrified. Get me a horse, I say. I've a cove I need to visit, and figure out a way to get in touch with Quinn. I look back at the beach, still littered with the remnants of destroyed ships. If this is as bad as I think it is, we're going to need all the help we can get. More than a week after I nearly died in Navium's streets, and a month after I arrived in the city, Grimmar launches his final assault. It comes at midnight. Corkan sails bob perilously close to shore, and drums from the eastern watchtower convey the worst. Grimmar is preparing to launch small craft to ferry his ground forces to Navium. He is sick of waiting, sick of having his supply lines cut off by Karras, sick of being starved out. He wants the city. Navium's catapults are a blur of fire and stone, a paltry defense against the hundreds of ships shooting flaming projectiles into the city. From the island, the Commandant issues orders to the 2,500 men waiting in the ruins of the southeast quarter, where the Corkans are expected to land. They are, Dex tells me, mostly Orcs, plebeians. Good men, many of whom will die if my plan doesn't work. Dex finds me in the courtyard of the Blackguard barracks, where the plebeians who have taken shelter grow increasingly agitated. Many have family members, who will face off with Grimmar and his hordes today. All have been forced to flee their homes. With every minute that passes, the chances that they'll have anything to return to grow less likely.
We're ready, Shrike,
Dex says. At my order, 2 dozen men, men who have done nothing but follow orders, will die. Runners, drum tower guards, the drummers themselves. If we want to beat Grimmar, we must beat the Commandant, and that means cutting her lines of communication. We can take no chances. After the drums are silenced, we will have minutes, if that, to enact our plan. Everything must go right.
You want to destroy her? You have to become her first.
I give Dex the order, and he disappears, a group of 20 men going with him. Moments later, Avitas arrives with a scroll. I hold it up. The mark of Karras Veturia, a K, is clearly visible to the plebeians closest to me. The news spreads quickly. Karras Veturia, commander of the city, the woman who has allowed the plebeian sectors of Navium to burn, has sent the Bloodshrike and the Black Guard a message. I send a silent thank you to Cook, wherever she is. She got me that seal, risking herself in the process, delivering it to me with a terse warning.
Whatever you have planned, it better be good, because when she hits back, it will be hard, in the place you least expect it, in the place where it will hurt the most.
I open the missive, which is empty, pretend to read it, and crush it, casting it into the closest fire, as if in a rage. The plebeians watch, resentment simmering, almost there. Almost. They are dry tinder ready to burst into flames. I have spent a week preparing them, slipping them stories of the Commandant feasting with Navium's paters while the plebeians starve. From there, the rumours bloom. Karras Veturia wants the Corkan ships to create a personal merchant fleet. The paters will allow the merciless warlock Grimmar to ransack the southeast quarter
if the Illustrian and Mercator districts are saved. Lies all, but each has enough truth to be plausible and wrath-inducing. I will not accept this! I speak loudly enough for the room to hear. My rage is an act, but I quickly stoke it into reality. All I have to do is recall Karis's crimes. She gave up thousands of lives just to get her hands on those ships for the Nightbringer's War. She persuaded a passel of weak-minded paters to put their greed ahead of their people. She is a traitor, and this is the first step to taking her down.
Shrike!
Avitas takes a step back, playing his part with impressive skill.
Orders are orders.
Not this time, I say. She cannot just sit there in that tower, a tower she stole from the finest admiral this city ever knew, and expect that we won't challenge her.
We don't have the men.
If you go to challenge Karis Veturia,
a Blackguard ally planted amid the crowd and dressed in plebeian clothing speaks up,
then I will go with you. I have grievances of my own.
And I.
Two more men stand, both allies of Jens Aquila and Jens Atria. I look to the rest of the plebeians.
Come on, come on.
And I. The woman who speaks is not one of mine, and when she stands, her hands on a cudgel, she is not alone. A younger woman beside her, who looks to be a sister, stands with her. Then a man behind her.
And I.
More chime in, urged on by those around them, until all are on their feet. It is a replica of the riot Mamie Reela planned, except this time the rioters are at my back. As I turn to leave, I note that Avitas has disappeared. He will bring the orc soldiers, whom he turned to our cause, as well as plebeians from the other shelters we've opened. We spill into the streets, heading for the island, and when Harper finds me with his people, I have a mob at my back. Avitas marches by my side, a torch in one hand, his sim in the other. For once, his face is angry instead of calm. Harper is plebeian, but like all masks, he keeps his emotions close. I never once thought to ask him how he felt about what was happening in the plebeian quarters.
Eyes ahead, Shrike.
He glances at me, and I'm unnerved that he seems to know what I'm thinking.
Whatever you're feeling guilty about, you can deal with it later.
When we finally reach the bridge to the island, the city guards, alerted to our approach, close ranks. As I march up to them, an orc bursts through the crowd, exactly on time.
The Corkans have attacked the drum towers,
he says breathlessly to the captain of the city guard, a plebeian himself.
They've killed the drummers and the guards. There's no way for the commandant to communicate with the men.
The city will fall if you do not move, I say to the guard captain. Let me past and be remembered as a hero, or continue to defend her and die a coward.
No need for dramatics, Bloodshrike.
Across the bridge, the large wooden doors that lead to the island tower are open. The commandant emerges, backed by a dozen paters. Her cold voice shakes, the slightest tremor of rage. Behind her, the paters take in the sims and torches and angry faces arrayed before them. Silently, the guards stand aside, and we cross the bridge.
Shrike, the commandant says. You do not understand the delicate workings of... We're dying out here, an angry voice calls out, while you dine on roast fowl and fresh fruit in a tower that doesn't belong to you.
I hide a smirk. One of the paters had a shipment of fruit delivered to the island 3 days ago. I ensured that news of that delivery got back to the plebeians.
General Veturia!
A runner arrives from the southeast quarter, and this time it's not one of mine.
The Corkans have made landfall. The warlock Ramar leads the charge, and his men are pouring into the quarter. There are reports of pyres being built. A group of marshals who were caught refused to swear fealty to Grimar and were thrown on the pyre. Our troops need orders, sir.
Karis hesitates. It's just one moment, one instant of weakness.
You want to destroy her? You have to become her first.
I'm taking control of this military operation. I shove past her, past the paters, and motion Avatas and the Orc soldiers, who have moved to the front of the crowd, to follow. You have been relieved of duty, Caris Veturia. You are welcome to observe, as are the paters.
Let this work, please.
I head up the winding stairs, Avatas and the Orcs is at my back. When we reach the island's command level, Avatas lights a blue fire torch, and we keep moving up to the roof. All our hopes lie in that torch. It seems so small now, insignificant in the great dark night. He waves it thrice. We wait. And wait. Bleeding skies. We can't have gotten the timing right on every part of this plan, only for it to go wrong now.
Shrike!
Harper points to the western sea, where, from behind a craggy hook of land, a forest of masts emerges. The Marshall Fleet. Gasps echo from the plebeians, who I ensured followed us up to the top of the tower. To a man, the paters appear either ill or terrified. As for the Commandant, in the years I have known her, I've never seen her shocked or even mildly surprised. Now her face and knuckles go so white she could be a corpse. The fleet didn't sink that night, I hiss at her. It sailed away, and you had your gin master stir up old shipwrecks to wash to shore, so that our people would believe the Marshall Fleet had gone under, and that I was to blame. I went to the beach, Caris, got past all your guard dogs, the masts, the sails, all the detritus that washed up. They were from ships that must have been under the sea for decades. Why would I hide the fleet? That's preposterous. Because you need those ships for the Nightbringer's war with Marin and the Scholars, I snap at her. So you thought you'd wait out the Corkans, let a few thousand plebeians die, let that bastard Grimmar attack on land, decimate his forces, steal his ships. Suddenly, you'd have a fleet twice the size of the Mariner's. Admiral Argus and Vice Admiral Vesellius will never follow your orders. So you admit that they're alive? I almost laugh. I'd wondered why their gens mourned while their wives didn't appear upset at all. Narvium's drum towers suddenly begin thundering orders, my own drummers sending messages in place of those Dex and his men killed. A squad of runners appears from the base of the watchtower. They had only been awaiting my signal. I relay orders to the men in the southwest quarter, who by now must be facing pitched battles with the Corkan invaders.